You're listening to the Mind Over Murder podcast.
My name is Bill Thomas. I'm a writer, consulting producer, and now podcaster. I am now trying to use my experience as the brother of a murder victim to help other victims of violent crime. I'm working on a book on the unsolved Colonial Parkway murders, and I'm the co-administrator of the Colonial Parkway Murders Facebook group together with Kristen Dilley.
My name is Kristen Dilley. I'm a writer, a researcher, a teacher, and a victim's advocate, as well as the social media manager and co-administrator for the Colonial Parkway Murders Facebook page with my partner in crime, Bill Thomas. Welcome to Mind Over Murder. I'm Kristen Dilley.
And I'm Bill Thomas.
Welcome to an episode of True Crime News Roundup. This is the third such in that series, and that's just because there's a ton of true crime news.
Before we get to true crime news, Kristen Dilley,
yes,
we have some news of our own.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. And I'm very excited about it. I'm too excited for words. So I'm going to let you announce our big news, Mr. Thomas.
You're kidding. I thought you were going to announce it.
Maybe we can say it together.
We have reached an important plateau for two young podcasters who are new to this business and still bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. We have reached
1 million downloads.
The crowd goes wild.
Yes. We were just saying off air that we wish we had $1 for every single download, because that would mean we'd have $1 million.
That's true. Just in case anybody starts thinking that, that is not the case.
That's not how it equates, unfortunately.
But we realized a couple of weeks ago that sometime around the 1st of April, give or take, we were going to cross over 1 million downloads. Now, we've been on two podcasting platforms, one called Anchor and then one called Spreaker. And we're very happy here at Spreaker, and they've been great to us. When you look at your statistics, which is how many downloads did you have this week and how many this month and that kind of thing, and our numbers have been good and we've been very pleased. You don't think about it all that much, though. Because we were on Anchor and then Spreaker, our number total downloads to date was divided. So I'd forgotten about it. And then Kristen and I were talking about this a few weeks ago, and I said something about, I think we're going to hit 1 million downloads. And so she said, check when you get a chance. And lo and behold, we very quietly went over 1 million downloads. And so here we are.
I'm flabbergasted, I guess would be the best word. It's pretty cool.
It is. It's hard to believe that it happened. And of course, now we've been at this for what, 3 years and a bit?
Yeah, about that. Yeah.
The most important thing to do is we want to thank all of you for your support. This is incredible. We didn't expect that this would ever happen. We know other podcasters that have hit other plateaus, including people that hit 1 million downloads a month and crazy numbers like that. We're enjoying this immensely. It's a lot of work, but I think it's something that we're both still enjoying.
Yes.
And we will continue to bring you Mind Over Murder. Please tell your friends. And as Kristen says from time to time, don't forget those 5-star reviews. Again, thank you all very much for your support. So here we are.
Yeah, this is phenomenal. And as Bill said, we do enjoy doing the podcast very much. And we thank all of you, especially our listeners who have been with us from minute one. Because we do have a number of people out there who we know have stuck with us through our whole entire 3 years. So if you are our longest of the long-term listeners, thank you for sticking with us. We appreciate it. We know that sometimes it's not easy growing a podcast, and there is a learning curve, and sometimes some episodes are better than others, but thank you for sticking with us. For those of you guys that have been here from the very first moment, we really appreciate it, and we hope you continue to stick with us.
I think we got better over time. Those first couple of episodes that we recorded at your kitchen table over Christmas time, that would have been late 2019.
Yep, late 2019.
When I go back and listen to them, which I don't do very often, I think we sound a little nervous and like we're still finding our way. but it's gotten better and easier, and it's something that we both really enjoy. I like the podcast where it's just the two of us, and I like the podcast where we have guests as well. They're both interesting in their own way.
Definitely. And we've just had the nicest group of people who has been willing to come on and talk about their expertise and share their love of crime and forensics and DNA and IgG. I think, as you've pointed out a time or two, no one has ever turned us down and said, yeah, absolutely not. I'm not going to show up on your podcast. So it's been wonderful to have all of these amazing people who are willing to share their time and energy and enthusiasm with us, because that makes our job a whole lot easier and better too. I'm not saying that I wouldn't enjoy talking with you and doing episodes just one-on-one every single day, but I think it's a lot of fun when we get to have Mark Olshaker and Jim Fitzgerald and Ann Burgess and everyone else. So thank you to everybody who has guested with us, and to everybody who continues to listen to us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. So what's new in true crime news, he asked.
Oh my gosh, so much. This last week in particular was really crazy, to the extent that I found myself going to our social media page a couple of times in one day. I think this was Tuesday, the 28th of March. And I just found myself going, oh, here's another story. Here's another one. Oh, here's a third. It was a busy news day. And I would say probably the most stunning of the stories to come out of the true crime space in the last week or so was the fact that Adnan Syed's conviction was reinstated by a Maryland appeals court. I saw that headline come over my news feed and I nearly dropped my phone. It was absolutely crazy. Did you see the news when it first came up, or like most things, did you end up getting a story from me and go, oh no, what is this?
That happens a lot too. But in this particular example, I had seen the story as well. The stories that initially ran were incredibly unclear as to what that actually meant. And we do want to explain that. I still think this is a bizarre story, even now that we understand how this is actually going to work. This case has been mishandled from the start, and I will offer the opinion it continues to be mishandled even in these latest developments.
Yeah, exactly. So let's go ahead and get into it. So as I said, in a very startling and stunning turnaround on March 28th, Maryland's appeals court reinstated the murder conviction against Adnan Syed, and that is about 6 months after he was freed from prison for the 1999 murder of his girlfriend, Hayman Lee. So here's ultimately what happened. The Maryland Appeals Court agreed that Hayman Lee's family had not been given sufficient notice to attend the hearing that ultimately ruled that the conviction should be vacated. So until a new hearing can be held about the evidence that was used to vacate his conviction, the charges against him have been reinstated. That does not mean, however, that he is going back to prison. And I think that was the first concern that everybody had upon hearing that is, does that mean this poor man has to go back to prison? And thankfully, that does not seem to be. I'm going to actually quote from NBC here because they have some excellent reporting. In a lot of cases, they have stated things better than I can. So according to reporting from NBC, Tuesday's decision and the new hearing are seen as a procedural issue, and there is no reason to believe that Syed will be sent back to prison. Adnan's attorney, Erica Souter, had this to say with regard to this newest twist in the Adnan Syed case. Quote, "The appeal is not about Adnan's innocence, but about notice and mootness. There is no basis for re-traumatizing Adnan by returning him to the status of convicted felon. Ensuring justice for Hayman Lee does not require injustice for Adnan," which I think is a very good point.
Agreed. I still find myself shaking my head because I think this is not really rectifying the situation, but I'll let you continue.
So here's the sequence of events that happened that set all of this in motion. Prosecutor Becky Feldman contacted Hayman Lee's brother, Young Lee, on September the 12th and let him know the state is filing a motion to vacate Adnan Syed's conviction in his sister's case. He was given only a few days' notice of the hearing time, which would have required him to fly from his home in California to attend in person, stated young Lee's lawyer. He ultimately was not able to get to the hearing in person. He was able to Zoom in on a Zoom call, but the family has basically stated that's not enough. We needed to be able to be there in person. Bill, as the family member of a murder victim, how is that sitting with you?
Well, I feel like the prosecution completely blew this thing. If they thought about this more than a few days in advance and thought to notify young Lee with a reasonable amount of notice, I think the thing I find most frustrating about this situation is that this obviously wasn't decided in a day. This was in process, I would say, at a minimum for weeks and more likely for months. They should have thought to invite Lee's family sooner than just a few days beforehand. He's supposed to drop everything he's doing and fly from California to Maryland to attend this hearing. And now I feel like the decision to go back and do a redo almost on this hearing, according to the reporting we've seen so far with NBC, New York Times, and other publications, there's no expectation of a different outcome here. It's pretty easy for me to put myself, I think, in Lee's position because he's the brother of a murder victim and he wanted to be there and he should have been given sufficient notice. What I'm not clear on is how does going back and doing a perfunctory revisitation of this hearing with the same outcome, how is that really helping things?
Exactly. And there actually was a dissenting judge in this case, Judge Stuart Berger. He basically said in an opinion about the decision to reinstate his conviction, quote, Lee's family does not have a right to speak at the hearing over whether to vacate a conviction, and electronic attendance was most likely sufficient to satisfy the family's rights, as in to attend. The trial judge also allowed Lee's brother to make a statement to the court. So he said in his mind, like you said, why are we doing this? It should have been enough for them to be on a Zoom conference because them being in the courtroom wasn't going to affect the outcome anyway. And Adnan's lawyer did say, we are living in a state now, we're not at a state of emergency anymore with COVID, but we are still living in a state where Zoom calls are the norm. Witness you and I doing a podcast via Zoom. She feels that a Zoom conference is more than sufficient to satisfy that right of the Lee family being able to attend a hearing and offer an impact statement. There are definitely people on both sides who are like, why are we doing this a second time? It's not going to change the outcome of it. It is very odd.
Yeah, I find the whole thing incredibly frustrating. If the prosecutors had done this right the first time, if they'd given the Lee family sufficient notice, we wouldn't be having this discussion. And I don't see how doing this all over again, now that Adnan Syed's sentence has been vacated, I don't see how this do-over is getting us anything here. If anything, now we're driving Syed's nightmares because it does appear that he did not kill Haemin Lee after serving all of these years. And so now we create all of this uncertainty 6 months after this gentleman was released. The whole thing has been so badly handled. I'm flabbergasted. I understand the Lee's frustration and even anger at not being consulted and not being given sufficient notice, but I don't see how this resolves anything.
I agree with you. The day after this announcement, so Wednesday, March 29th, Rabia Chaudhry, who has done the most work on Adnan's case, went ahead and hosted an Instagram live session so that she could explain what's going on. And it was, you could just feel the frustration radiating off of her. This has obviously been an ordeal for everybody involved in the Syed case. And I'm not saying that the Lee family hasn't had a hard time. Of course they have. But this really does seem to be like, what are we going to accomplish with this? Other than basically saying, hey, we screwed up the first time procedurally. Let's fix that now.
I don't think you get a do-over on something like this. They can't fix this. This seems completely pointless to me.
So we don't have, or at least I was unable to find at this point today, April 5th, when a new hearing will be scheduled, but I have to assume it will be fairly soon. We'll continue to post updates about Adnan Syed's conviction hearings and so on and so forth. But let's hope that the second time around, the redo, his conviction is once again vacated and he does continue to walk as a free man after all of these years.
I did see some reporting that referenced a 60-day time frame. So that would be from March 28th to approximately May 28th. I think this will be resolved one way or another by the end of May.
Let's hope so.
In other news, we've been a little hesitant to cover this case because we found that when we've discussed school shootings on Mind Over Murder in the past, immediately everything seems to get so politically polarized between our friends who are on the liberal side of the conversation and on the conservative side of the same conversation. And then, of course, we have a lot of people that are somewhere in the middle. I don't think we can let this pass without offering you some sort of update regarding the Nashville Covenant shooting. This past week, the Nashville Police Department released an inventory of the property that was seized from 28-year-old Audrey Hale after last week's mass shooting at the Covenant School. Hale has killed 3 9-year-old students at Covenant School, as well as 3 adults, 3 administrators at the school, including the head of school and a beloved custodian. This terrible incident unfolded in less than 14 minutes from the time the police were called to the time that the Nashville Police Department responding in an incredibly professional and brave way. Those of you that saw the video of the officers making their way into the school and quickly clearing room after room while seeking the shooter, I couldn't help but think of Uvalde and the completely botched response from the law enforcement people in Texas versus the incredible job that these officers did in Nashville. You're not going to see me shed any tears to see a school shooter shot to death, thus preventing additional children and staff and others being put at risk. But
yeah, that body cam footage was incredible.
I have heard some criticism in recent days that as well done as that operation was, people that are Marine Corps trained and other people who have serious military training said, even though the Nashville Police Department did an outstanding job, there are lessons to be learned from that outcome and that those officers took steps which may have put themselves at greater risk if they'd been going up against someone who was more experienced, perhaps. There's been some back and forthing in the media about whether we're going to call Audrey he or she. I've actually been defaulting more to she recently. It does appear that Audrey was in the process of transitioning, and I don't think that has anything to do with her mental illness or the fact that she killed 6 people and then got herself killed, basically, by the Nashville Police Department.
Yeah, most of the reporting that I've seen has defaulted to she. It has been a little bit of a question in my mind, like, how should we be doing, what pronouns should we be using to reference the shooter as we do our reporting? And because most of the news media outlets have been defaulting to she, that's the stance that we're going to take, at least on my side, I will. And that is not meant in any way to be disrespectful and their gender identity. That just seems to be how most people are referring to it. And so that is going to be my default as well, unless proven otherwise or given other instructions. So I just want to make sure that we're clear on the pronouns there.
There is a manifesto, if you will, that is supposed to be released at some point once the FBI and other law enforcement agencies signal that it's okay to be released. It's very clear now in the past few days with additional reporting that we were talking about someone who's seriously mentally, apparently was planning this assault for months. She had studied previous mass shooters and had an incredibly detailed plan about how she was going to take out this school where she had once been a student. Among the items seized from the shooter's home, where she lived with her parents, in addition to the weapons that she carried to the school, was a 12-gauge Mossberg 590, a 20-gauge Winchester 1200, miscellaneous firearms, accessories, and ammo, a bag with targets and empty ammo boxes, 6 different laptops, 7 different cell phones, at least 20 journals, including items labeled psych folder / medical folder. She had hung on to 5 years of yearbooks from the Covenant School and a school photo, and then, of course, the required suicide note. The whole thing just seems incredibly sad, and as usual, I find myself thinking, is there any way this could have been prevented? Because the ramp up here to the shooting is so pronounced. She purchased 7 weapons in a matter of days. And I think that's something that we as a society need to be looking at. Should we be permitting people to buy multiple guns and thousands of rounds of ammunition in fairly short order? I think that's usually a sign that there's something seriously going wrong here.
I was looking at this inventory item list, and this was the actual photos of that inventory were posted by the New York Post. And I'm getting all of the contents of this from that inventory list. I was interested in 2 things in particular. Number one, one of the inventory items lists 3 folders and 14 journals. It looked like it could have been either 14 or 19. I'm going to err on the side of 14. It said 3 folders, 14 journals, and then behind it in parentheses, it read school shootings and firearms courses. So I'm thinking that this is the studying related to school shootings and mass murderers that has been referenced in the press over the last couple of days. So it sounds like she had done a great deal of research. And I was interested in just one item on that list that had been entirely redacted, and that is item number 23 on the inventory sheet. So there's 47 items in total on that inventory list, things that were taken from the house, but number 23 is the only item that was entirely redacted. And so now, of course, I'm very interested in what item number 23 is, hoping that there will be some further information on that moving forward.
And then, of course, this manifesto, these documents are usually so sad. And it will be interesting to see what comes out of this. But clearly, this is an individual who is very disturbed. We're not here to discuss gun control at any length. I don't think there's much way around this. And I don't think this is an outrageous overstatement to say that we as a country need to do something. This is the only country in the world. The United States is the only country in the world where we're seeing this problem over and over again. And why is it that places like Australia and New Zealand and the United Kingdom, when they've had mass shootings, have managed to take reasonable steps to prevent mass shootings of this type? We're not trying to take anyone's guns away. We're not trying to eliminate the Second Amendment, which many of my conservative friends hold up as the Holy Grail. We have to do something as a country. We can't go on like this. Churches, synagogues, schools, mosques, movie theaters, grocery stores. I could just keep naming places. We're not ever going to be able to leave our house. And when I read about and talk with friends who've got young children who are confessing that they are memorizing their children's clothing every single day so they can identify their bodies when they come home from elementary school, I'm sorry, this is not the way we're supposed to be living our lives. I promise to climb off the soapbox here, but I really think all of us, gun owners and people that would never, ever own a gun, and everyone in the middle, we have to work together some kind of sensible, thoughtful approach so that crazy people cannot amass a group of weapons and go in and slaughter school kids in a school in Nashville or anywhere else. My biggest fear is that we're talking about Nashville right now, and we'll be talking about somewhere else next week. It happens over and over again. So end of rant. I tried very hard not to be political. But I think as a country, we've got to do.
And of course, as a teacher, this is a worst case scenario nightmare for me, who goes into a high school every single day of the teaching year, hoping and praying that this will not be the day that something happens at my school. And fortunately, we have such a wonderful school community where I teach, and couldn't ask for a better place to teach and to work and a better community.
You're listening to Mind Over Murder. We'll be right back after this word from our sponsors. We're back here at Mind Over Murder.
This actually does go directly to our next true crime news story, and that is the lawsuit that was filed against Newport News Public School from Abigail Zwerner, the 25-year-old teacher who was shot in her classroom by her 6-year-old student in January 2023. So it was just a couple of months ago. Abby has filed a $40 million lawsuit against former Richneck assistant principal Ebony Parker, principal Brianna Foster Newton, the Newport News School Board, and former superintendent George Parker III. Very interesting to read the details of this suit, because there is a lot of, I would have to say, damning information in there about the warnings that the school had about this student on the day of the shooting. And it exposed a series of failures in working with that student. Now, the student has not been named, of course, as we would expect. So he is referred to as John Doe in the lawsuit. So I'm going to go through a couple of the interesting pieces of information that came out in this lawsuit. So there were at least 3 separate warnings that the student had a gun on the day of the shooting. It came from staff members, and there was at least one student who came forward and told teachers that he saw the gun, that the student, John Doe, had revealed the gun to him. Administration still failed to act on this part. The lawsuit, interestingly, revealed a pattern of very upsetting and troubling behaviors from this 6-year-old. Things that made me as a teacher, it raised the hair on the back of my neck. So here's a couple of things that came out in this, the complaint for this lawsuit. And this is reporting from the Today Show and from our local newspaper here, the Daily Press, who has done an outstanding job thus far on all of the reporting that they've done. So we do know that the student, John Doe, attended Richneck Elementary School for kindergarten in the 2021-2022 school year. During that time, his kindergarten year, he, quote, strangled and choked a teacher and was removed from the school. During that same school year, he pulled up the dress of a student who had fallen on the ground and, quote, began to touch the child inappropriately until reprimanded by a teacher. That itself was just enough to make me go, whoa. What is happening with this child?
And why is this kid in a regular school? I'm sorry, I'll let you continue, but even just this first paragraph, I'm sitting here thinking, what in the world is little Johnny Doe doing in regular school? This kid is disturbed.
So after that, John Doe was placed in the Denby Early Childhood Center. He was allowed to return to Richneck for this current school year. At some point during the school year, and again, I know there's still a lot of information that has not been revealed and probably will not come out for a little bit. Sometime during the school year, he was placed on what's referred to as just a modified schedule in the complaint. The schedule was put in place after, quote, he chased students around the playground with a belt in an effort to whip them with it, as well as cursing at staff and teachers. And again, I'm stunned that this is behavior from a 6-year-old. I don't remember much about what I was like at 6. I just have trouble recognizing that I would have had the cognitive ability to do those things.
This is so outside my experience. A kid that might have been considered naughty or disruptive in the first grade, which admittedly was a long time ago for me, but this is so beyond anything I've ever experienced.
The complaint goes on to say that at least one parent was required to attend school with him daily because of his violent tendencies. I don't know where that's coming from. That is not a typical accommodation that is made in any plan for student behavior that I am aware of. Granted, I am not a special ed teacher. I work with many wonderful people who are special ed teachers, though. And in our own discussion of this case, none of them can recall a time in which that accommodation would have been made for a student. So I will be very interested to know, where did that accommodation plan, whatever you want to call it, where did that come from?
So John Doe's parents, one of them was supposed to be there every single day he was in school.
According to the complaint, yes. But I, like I said, I have never heard of that. Then again, I am a high school teacher. Yeah. And I know that we are very different from the elementary school teachers, but I've never heard of that before. I'm going to continue doing some reporting here from the Daily Press. We're going to go to this next quote here. Teachers' concerns with John Doe's behavior was regularly brought to the attention of Richneck Elementary School Administration, and the concerns were always dismissed. This is the part that also made me want to throw things. Quote, teachers' concerns with John Doe's behavior was regularly brought to the attention of Richneck Elementary School Administration, and the concerns were always dismissed. Often when he was taken to the school office to address his behavior, he would return to the classroom shortly thereafter with some type of reward, such as a piece of candy, end quote.
That's what we want to be doing, is rewarding this kid's horrifically bad behavior by sugaring him up and sending him back into the classroom.
Yeah, and I don't know what that's about either. It doesn't sound like any type of PBIS or positive behavior intervention strategy that people should be implementing. We've been told in professional development over the years that we should be trying to reinforce positive behavior and not reward negative behaviors. But this doesn't sound anything remotely close to something that we should be doing with children, especially one who is demonstrating violent tendencies like this. I don't know what's going on with that. Very interesting information coming out in this complaint. This also is interesting and new. On January 4th, 2 days before the shooting, John Doe slammed Abby Zwirner's cell phone into the ground and shattered it. For this, he received a one-day suspension, which he served on January 5th. That is the day before the shooting. On January 6th, he was supposed to return to school. He returned to school, as we now know, with a 9mm hand. His mother did not stay with him during the school day. Again, I'm not entirely clear what that's about. If the expectation is a parent has to come to school with you, why would you allow that student to be there by themselves? The complaint also stated that no one at the school assigned him a one-on-one companion. So he didn't have an aide or any other type of adult working with him during that day. Around 11:15 that day, Abby Zwirner approached administration with concerns that the student, quote, appeared to be in a violent mood. She stated he had already threatened to physically assault a classmate. Further, according to the complaint, the assistant principal, Ms. Parker, had no response and, in fact, would not even look at Abby Zwirner as she attempted to discuss the student.
This is insane. They're just completely not dealing with the fact that this kid is completely out of...
During the course of that day between 11:15 and the shooting, which took place at 1:59 in the afternoon, four teachers reported concerns about the student and the gun to administrators. A teacher went to the administration and stated that she thought she saw the student take an object out of his backpack and place it in the front pocket of his hoodie during recess. The assistant principal, Parker, dismissed that concern, saying that his pocket was, quote, too small to hold a handgun.
I'm so glad that assistant principal Parker is such an expert on firearms that she would know whether or not a handgun would fit in the pocket of his hoodie.
I was appalled by that. And that was one of the first things that came out, I think, during initial reporting, was that statement had happened, and it continues to appall. Four adults ultimately reported, we think this kid has a gun. The backpack was searched.
Which he did. He had a gun.
Which he did. He did. He had a gun.
Which he had gotten at home, and the parent or parents claim the gun was properly secured. But a six-year-old kid managed to take that gun and bring it fully loaded to school.
At 1:59 p.m., Abby Zwirner was shot in her classroom. The bullet went through her left hand, which she held up to deflect what was coming. The bullet went through her hand and into her chest. The bullet fragments do remain lodged there. She has had a number of surgeries at this point on her hand. And according to the interview she recently did on the Today Show, it looks like there may be another couple in order. She said the bullet fragments are going to stay in her chest for now. And ultimately, that resulted in a 10-day hospital stay. At this point, she is working to regain that equilibrium to do the physical therapy and everything else that's required. I wish Abby nothing but the best. I think that the Newport News Public School Division 100% needs to be held accountable for what happened at that school. The administrators who were in the building at that time need to be held accountable to it. There has been some discussion from the principal who states that she was never made aware of the situation with this student. She did not know that there was a gun on campus or a threat of a gun on campus that day. There was even some discussion on a local news station the other day that she is threatening to bring a countersuit against Abigail Zwirner because of her being named in the suit. I'll be interested to see whether that continues.
By the way, for this principal to admit that she had no idea of the problems with this child is unbelievable. I saw the articles that mentioned that the principal was considering filing a countersuit. Way to show support for your teachers by filing a lawsuit when you are the responsible person running that school and you and your assistant principal have failed on every single level to protect the students and your faculty. I understand that from a defense perspective, the principal's lawyers may be advising her that she may have to file a countersuit. Wow, this does not sit well.
No, it doesn't. My heart goes out to Abby. It truly does. I'm friends with her aunt. She is a very dear and special person to me. I've been following everything that has happened here with Abby with the hope that she has the best possible outcome here. She has a long road ahead of her, and I feel that there is no amount of money that can repair the damage that has been done to her physically, emotionally, mentally. She has every right to file this lawsuit, and I hope that it is successful. When we had posted this on our social media pages, I did have a friend who pushed back and was like, you know what? $40 million is too much. That's not fair. You shouldn't be doing that because that's going to impact the school's budget. I think she deserves every penny of it and more. That is also coming from someone who feels very deeply for what Abby is going through. But what are your thoughts on the price tag there, Bill?
Well, the price tag is just an opening volley. As someone who's negotiated all sorts of contracts and agreements, record deals, you name it, $40 million is a starting point. You have to put a figure out there. She could have said it was $100 million. It doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to end up at $40 million. But keep in mind, this is a 25-year-old teacher who was right at the beginning of her career. Depending on how badly damaged her hand is, she may not be able to teach, or she may have to go through the rest of her life with pain and suffering. She's 25 years old. She could be alive for 75 more years, living with the pain of the consequences that came about because this school system failed to protect her and her students. There have to be consequences here. This, as you said, Kristen, falls to the Newport News school system. They failed to protect Abby and her students and did a disservice to everyone, up to and including John Doe, the shooter. One other thing I'm still baffled by, and I will be completely infuriated if there are not ultimately charges filed against the parents, because these people allowed this kid access to a deadly weapon, which he took to school and shot his teacher. There's no way around that. And no responsible parent is going to allow their six-year-old access to a deadly firearm. we're lucky he didn't kill the teacher or other people that day. That could have easily happened. As it is, we have a teacher who was very badly injured and fortunately will survive. $40 million, it's just a number. It's just the start of a conversation. There will be a settlement, in my opinion, and it will be substantial. And it should serve as a reminder to Newport News and every school system around the country. You can't just ignore the fact that multiple people are reporting problems with a particular child, and on a given day, four different adults reported that they believe this kid had a gun. One thing that's not mentioned here, but we did talk about it a few weeks ago when we spoke about this case, there was some hope that they'd get to the end of the school day and the kid would go home with the gun. You just think to yourself, are you insane? That's your resolution?
The law of the land since 9/11 really was, if you see something, say something. And of course, that went for suspicious packages and various places like that. There are signs posted in every school district. If you see something, say something. Four people outside of Abigail's Werner saw something, said something, and it was roundly ignored. That is a major, major problem for me as an educator, but I think for everybody in general. If the rule of the land is going to be, if you see something, say something, you cannot afford to ignore it when people say something. That's only some of the true crime news, believe it or not, that has hit over the last week or so in between the last time that we recorded episodes, and I'm sure there is going to be more. We have information to share with you about the exhumation and autopsy of Stephen Smith as related to the Alec Murdaugh investigation. We also have information about Doomsday mom Lori Vallow and her trial, which is about to start. So I would say expect another round of true crime news coming your way in the not too distant future.
Sounds good.
If you like what we're doing here on the podcast, please do make sure that you leave us a 5-star rating and review on any and all of your podcast platforms. That does count for our social media as well. Please, there are places where you can leave reviews on our Mind Over Murder Facebook page, and we do hope you take the time to do that as well. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Mind Over Murder. We'll see you next time.
Mind Over Murder is a production of Absolute Zero and Another Dog Productions.
Our executive producers are Bill Thomas and Kristen Dilley.
Our logo art is by Pamela Arnois.
Our theme music is by Kevin MacLeod.
Mind Over Murder is distributed in partnership with Crawl Space Media.
You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram.
You can also follow our page on the Colonial Parkway Murders on Facebook.
And finally, you can follow Bill Thomas on Twitter at BillThomas56.
Thank you for listening to Mind Over Murder.